And there you go. And I'm going to turn spotlight for everyone. And share screen. Okay, you should now see the text of the screen on your screens. And the only other thing I'm going to do is there's a new source page today, so I'm going to throw that into the chat if anybody wants a copy of it. And we'll start everybody on mute. But you have control of your, over the mute button, so feel free to unmute and just chime in as you wish. I think I mentioned before, the shortcut to unmuting is to just to hold the space bar. Functions like a microphone button. So if you just hold it down, it unmutes temporarily. You let go, and it's back to mute. So just a shortcut to be aware of. Okay, we're moving on to our second unit, if you will. First one was David and Bathsheba and the relationship and the complexity of that initial contact. And we spent a lot of time talking about the status of Uri and Bathsheba's marriage and the question of Uriah's, either the question of the get or the question of Uriah's status as a Jewish status, the legality of the marriage. None of that matters really in the objective moral sense of it, but for David, kind of a process of self-justification that we've identified. And then on top of that, you have the complexity of Uriah and Bathsheba's role and relationship and the possibility that Uriah's been at battle for some number of years. They have no children. That raises the question of the nature of that relationship and whether Uriah and Bathsheba's marriage is as healthy or as normal as we would otherwise have expected. All of that, again, from a legal perspective, is not relevant. From a moral perspective, is not relevant. From a legal perspective, it helps process the series of mistakes going through David's mind as he tumbles down the rabbit hole. Which brings us to the next part of this discussion, which is Uriah. So we are up to Pasuk Hey. Let's start from Pasuk Dalet. After David and Bathsheba have their night together, Batashav el Beita, she returns to her house. Batah ha'isha v'tishlach v'tagid David v'tomer hara anochi. Bathsheba realizes that she's pregnant. She sends a message to David and says, I am with child. Clearly, with Uriah being at the front and David being the only one who's been with her this whole time, the paternity of this child is not in question. Eishlach David el Yoav. David sends a message to Yoav. Shlach elai et Uriah hachiti. Send me Uriah hachiti. David, so Yoav sends Uriah from the front to David. What is the pretense for David's call of Uriah from the front? We'll see the intention in a second. But what is the pretense of David's call of Uriah? That becomes evident in the next pasuk. Vayavo Uriah elav, Uriah comes, vayishal David lishlom Yoav, lishlom ha'am, lishlom ha'milchama. Uriah inquires, peace, what is the status of Dov, of Yoav, what is the status of the people, how is the war going? He wants a report. And in the context of the way wars were conducted in those days, I think that was pretty standard. We see at the end of the story as well, when the battle against Rabbah begins, and the siege is broken, Yoav will again send a report to David at the end of the parak. And there again, he sends a messenger. The messenger reports to David, all that happened. This was common practice to send a messenger from the front to the king who's in the sitting at the sort of not on the battlefield, but in the whether in the command post or in this case in the palace, to send a messenger. And so the next report, David says he wants Uriah to come and deliver this report. So that essentially is the pretense, if you will, of David's request that it be Dafka Uriah that comes to him. And Uriah comes, and that's exactly how the conversation begins. Vayishal David lishlom Yoav. Tell me, how is everything going? So that's exactly what happens. But then we get to the real intention of David in this process. Vayomer David l'Uriah, after the report has been given, David says to Uriah, Red lebetcha urachatz raglecha. Go to your house and wash your feet. Which is a very powerful euphemism for furlough, go home to your wife. And Uriah refuses. Ve'itzeh Uriah mibet ha-melech, v'atetzeh achra mas'at ha-melech. Uriah departs from the house, the king's house, followed with a mess of food from the king. Ve'ishkav Uriah petach bet ha-melech et kol avdei adonav. Uriah sleeps at the door of the king's house, meaning with all the servants of the king, in the wherever the dormitory was for all of the servants. Ve'lo yarad el beto, and he did not go down to his house. And that's where the beginning of the conflict starts with Uriah, where David challenges him for this refusal to follow David's instructions of going down to his house. We'll come back to the refusal in a moment and what it means for David. But I first want to just ask a basic question, which is an uncomfortable question. Nonetheless, I think it's self-evident in the course of this year that we are not shying away from the uncomfortable questions. What is David's intention in sending Uriah home? Why does he tell Uriah?
He wants to shift the paternity.
Right. So this is the beginning of the cover-up. This is clear. Mm-hmm. David says to Uriah, go home, chatz raglecha, wash your feet, spend the night with your wife. This is the beginning of David's cover-up. And if you look at the Mefarshim are very clear. I mention it, I think it's important to mention, because there is a certain element within contemporary common interpretation of Tanakh to try to literally whitewash and justify David's actions. And they want to make the claim that what David was trying to do was to demonstrate, was to trap Uriah into publicly having a fight with his wife so that people would know that Uriah and Dov and Bathsheba were really separated, which doesn't make any sense. If you look at the Mefarshim, they are very clear. Shlach elai ut Uriah. Why says Rashi and the Radak? Why does David ask to send Uriah? Sheyamit kaven sheyishkav imishto v'yehi savur shemimenu him uberet. David's intention was that Uriah should go home to his wife, and that everybody should think, therefore, that the child that she's carrying is Uriah's child, and that way cover up the David's misdeeds. The Rabbag says it more explicitly. All of this is a pretense to cover up his iniquity, his deficiency, his chet from other people. That people should not think that he is the one who sinned. But in fact, this is David's effort to avoid the public scrutiny of what transpired. Of course, it backfires because Uriah refuses. And that refusal leads to a very uncomfortable conversation between Uriah and David. I'm going to read that conversation first and then ask the basic question, what is the motivation that is taking place? So, v'yamar David l'Uriah, David says to Uriah, go home to your wife. Uriah refuses. He stays with the servants. He does not go home. Vayagidu leDavid lemor, lo yarad Uriah lebeito. David is thus informed that Uriah did not go down to his house. And of course, that puts David in a very uncomfortable position. So he calls Uriah back and he challenges him. Vayomer David Uriah el Uriah, halo miderech hataba. You've come from a long journey. You've come from the front. You've come all the way from Jordan. Madua lo yaradat al betecha. Why did you not go down to your house? Vayomer Uriah el David. Ha'aron v'Yisrael v'Yehuda yashvim basukot. The Ark and Israel and Judah, they're all abiding, all living in booths. Let's assume that means temporary dwelling on or tents in the battlefield. Some say it means the city of Sukkot. V'Adoni Yoav, and my master Yoav, v'Avdei Adoni, and the servants of my Lord, al pnei ha'sedechonim, the whole army, they are encamped in an open field. As soldiers in the battlefield at the moment of the siege, and I should go down to my house, eat and drink and sleep with my wife. On your life and on your soul, I will not do this thing.
He's more righteous than David at this point.
I'm not going to get into that question right now. We'll come back to it. There's much to be said, but I want to hold the judgment on this conversation for a few minutes. Vayomer David al Uriah. So David says to Uriah, "Shev bazeh gam hayom u'machar shalchecha. Okay, stay today, tomorrow I'll let you go." Vayeshev Uriah b'Yerushalayim b'yomahu macharat. So Uriah spends another night in Yerushalayim. The next day, David calls him, they eat, they drink. And the next night, too, he does not go home. Maybe David thought on an extra day, maybe he might miss his wife, maybe he might go home after a little bit of food and drink. Be that as it may, whatever David's intentions were, Uriah was having nothing of it. Uriah was not going home. The next day, David sends Yoav back to the front together with instructions for Yoav. Those instructions are a separate discussion we will have after we finish this unit. Okay, so let's go back to this conversation, Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph, which is the focus of our shiur tonight and part of next week. What is going on? David asks of Uriah a simple thing. Go home, spend the night with your wife. You've come from the battlefield. You've been spending a great deal of time on the battlefield. Go home. And Uriah says, I will not do so. So that raises a very simple question, which is, why is Uriah so stubbornly refusing to go home? His wife is waiting for him. He is coming from the front. David is his commander in chief. His king has given him a direct instruction to go home. And Uriah not only responds by saying, not only does he not do so, but he responds in a tone that is quite harsh. Aaron, Israel, Judah, Israel, the Ark, Judah, the army of Israel is sitting on the field, an open field in the middle of a war. I'm going to go home and spend the night with my wife. I'm in the middle of a battlefield. Why do you send me back? So to put it simply, the question for our discussion is, what is motivating Uriah's refusal to take David up at his request to have a night's furlough and to go home to his wife? What is driving Uriah's refusal? What's driving David's request is easy, that we said. David's hope is that Uriah's night with his wife will cover up his tracks and essentially turn the entire episode into a non-issue and nobody will be any wiser. Uriah says no and throws a monkey wrench into all of David's plans. And there are really only two possibilities for what is motivating Uriah's refusal. They are very extreme. Different extreme positions, but they are but they exist. What are the two options?
So one is he actually gave his wife a get.
I won't leave the get actually.
So he can't be with her.
I guess
it's not so obvious.
No, because a conditional get did not prevent soldiers from being able to come home. How that works is complicated, but nobody suggests that because they gave their wives conditional gittin, that means that they were literally couldn't come home from the field. From the battlefield, maybe, that would make no sense.
Maybe he doesn't want to be with her.
Okay, we could complicate the world by suggesting that there's some marital disputes and going on, etc. That gets too far afield from what's written. I'm going to keep life very simple. In the context of the text, there's really two very glaring possibilities. Number one,
loyal to David.
Say that again?
He's very loyal to David and to being a soldier. He's sort of like a...
I'm going to split your comment. He's very loyal to being a soldier. His loyalty to David, I'm going to hold off for judgment right now. But he's certainly loyal to being a soldier. And that, says the Malbim, is correct. The Malbim makes the argument that he is Messiah Levitumo, Shuret Salach Zolakrab. He wanted to go back to Mitoch Tumo. He answers innocently that his intention is to go back to the field. You pulled him out of the war. He had no intention of not being part of the war. He wants to go back to all of his compatriots who are sitting on the battlefield. All of my war buddies are on the field, and I'm going to go home and eat and drink and have a night. I need to go back to the war. What are you holding me here for? Send me back. That's a simple explanation. And I think that there's some truth to that.
Do you think he's trying to criticize David for not being at the war?
We'll come to that. There's some subtleties here which we will address in due time. But there's another possibility at the other end of the extreme, which I think we need to acknowledge is a real possibility. I just want to pull off. One second. I want to see if I can find it quickly.
Or maybe he heard about it. It was a secret.
Deborah, we'll come to that in a second. That's exactly where I want to go in a second. I'm just looking for a comment in the Malbim. When on this pasuk it Aleph, Yomor Yal David, when Uriah's response to David, the Ark and Israel and Judah and the army are all sitting on the camp, and I should go home to my wife. The Malbim says, "Vayomor Uriah." Sorry, this website kind of sometimes does funny things to me. Vayomor Uriah heshiv lefi tumo. He answered innocently. Shenim namizot. He didn't want to go home. He wanted to stay in the field. In other words, that is a legitimate possibility that his response is very innocent, and not necessarily something intentionally nefarious, but rather just a recognition that he really belongs on the battlefield and not at home. The other possibility, which I think W just alluded to, is that Uriah knows more than he is letting on. And it's not beyond the realm of possibility that Uriah is aware of what transpired between David and Bathsheba, or at least aware of the suspicions. As we said earlier, David sent for Bathsheba with messengers. Bathsheba sent messages back to David. This event happened at least a period of time ago, meaning at least long enough for Bathsheba to know that she's pregnant and to report that to David. So however length of time that is, a month, 2 months, this has been going on. And ultimately, Uriah may be more suspicious than he is letting on at face value. Does he know for sure? Unlikely. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I don't know. But there's certainly a sense, there could be a sense of him not being willing to play along with David's cover-up. Let's put it in those terms. If in fact something is happening, we don't know, but Uriah is possibly suspicious. He's not prepared to play along with David's attempt at a cover-up. But two possibilities. Either he refuses because he wants to be back on the field, he's a loyal soldier, or he refuses because he doesn't want to play, he doesn't want to be party to David's efforts to cover up his own transgressions. Though those are the major two possibilities. I present it in those terms because there is a well-known dispute between Rashi and Tosfot over this issue, over what's happening here at this moment. And the simplest way to explain the dispute between Rashi and Tosfot, which I'll show you in a moment, is to place them in the heart of this debate, meaning what is driving Uriah's motivation behind his refusal. So the issue here goes back to a medrash that we referred to earlier when we discussed Rabbi Shimon ben Nachmani, namely, to what level of degree does David justify for himself ultimately sending Uriah to his death? And I want to preface that with a comment that I made a number of times. I'm not suggesting for a moment that he is justified in sending Uriah to his death, that the Navi holds him squarely accountable for that. What I am looking for is to understand in David's mind what David thought when he sentenced Uriah to go back to the front in a way that would cause Uriah's death. You could argue that he just wanted him out of the way so that he was free to deal with Bathsheba. But the Gemara saw in David's response something more significant. It's based on a Gemara, it appears twice. It appears in the Gemara in Kiddushin. It appears also in the Gemara in Shabbos and Shmuel Menachmeni, which we discussed a number of weeks ago. The Gemara there is talking about a very interesting question, which we will look at again later in this course from a different angle. Namely, there's a principle known as Ein Shliach L'Dvar Avera. If I ask somebody to do something which is a transgression, which is a violation of Jewish law, but I ask them to do it, and they're doing it as my agent, who's responsible? So in modern civil law, there's a notion of accomplice and et cetera, intention. But in Jewish law, if I tell somebody, go and steal something for me, the person who does the stealing is guilty. I told him to go. He didn't have to listen to me. So that's a principle in Jewish law. The question is, does it apply to murder? If I tell somebody to go and kill somebody and they do it, to what level or degree am I, the person who sent him, responsible? So that's the Gemara, that's the discussion of the Gemara in Kiddushin. It will revolve around the question of Yoav, who ultimately causes Uriah's death, but does so on David's request to say so. If a person says to a shaliach, go and kill somebody, hu chayav shluchav patur, I, the person who sent that individual who hired the murderer, I am accountable. Shalchav, sorry, the person who commits the murder is responsible. Shalchav, the person who sends him, hires him, he is exempt according to the first opinion. Shammai Azakin, Omer Mishum Chagai Navi. Shammai Azakin says in the name of Chagai Navi. Shalchav Chayav, the person who sends him is also Chayav. As it says, Shene'emar, Oto Haragta Becherev B'nei Amon. David is held accountable for the death of Uriah, even though it is Yoav who actually causes his death. So that places that responsibility on the shaleach, on the person who sends him, in this case, the king. And the question is the king a unique status, or is it something that can be derived or learned from for everybody else? Says the Gemara, the idach, the first opinion says that David is not accountable. When Natan says to him that you killed Uriah, b'cher b'nei Ammon, he's comparing the death of Uriah to the war with Ammon. Ma cher b'nei Ammon en etanen. Nashalav, you are not a punished. You are not, David, accountable being punished for the war with Ammon. Therefore, af Uriah chiti etanen i'etanen. Nashalav, you're also not being held accountable for the death of Uriah, says this opinion. Why not? Listen carefully. Because Uriah deserved to be put to death. Uriah mored b'malchutava. He was guilty of treason. He was guilty of rebellion. He was guilty of treason. And because he was guilty of treason, David sentences him to death as a person guilty of treason. And for that itself, he's not being accountable, says this opinion in the Gemara. Why does the Navi say to him, wait a second, and the Navi comes and the Navi criticizes David for Uriah's death. So there, the continuation of this piece of the Gemara is that the Gemara in Shabbos, which is Shayalach aladunobis Sanhedrin velodanta. What David was accountable for was the fact that Uriah's rebellion, Uriah's treason, Uriah's insubordination should have been addressed by the Sanhedrin, by the court, and not by David. Okay, park that last sentence on the side. We'll deal with it as a separate discussion. I want to understand this. Uriah is guilty of treason, says the Gemara, and therefore David was right, or at least justified, in having him killed. At least in David's mind. Okay, what's the treason? The ka'amalei for Uriah saying to David in the course of their discussion, v'adoni Yoav v'avdei adoni apnei asadeh chonim. The words, adoni Yoav v'avdei adoni apnei asadeh chonim, my master Yoav and the servants of my master are all sitting in the camp on the field. Those words are treason. And if you're as confused as I am, we're in good shape.
Well, he didn't say my master David.
Where is the treason? So here there's a machloket between Rashi and Tosfot. And this machloket, Rashi and Tosfot, on the face of it is very technical. When we dig down beneath the surface, what we find is, I think, this debate, whether or not Uriah suspects David or is just super loyal to his own unit. So let's take a look. So first of all, we'll start with Rashi. We're going to start with Rashi. We're going to come back to Rashi. Rashi says, Adoni Yoav, ze mered shekra'o Adon bifnei melech. The rebellion is that Uriah calls Yoav, who is the general of the army, he calls him my master, my lord, in the presence of the king. In other words, he doesn't refer to David as his Adon, his master. He refers to Yoav as his master, whereas in fact, Yoav is the servant of the king. And by calling the servant my master, that's treason. So says Rashi. Park that for a minute. Comes to Tosfot. Now, Tosfot raises, and he quotes Rashi, Pirish Bekuntris to Moredaya. According to Rashi, he is guilty of treason for calling Yoav his master. Viloni here says Tosfot, it doesn't make sense. Yoav himself was very loyal. Yoav himself was not, how loyal Yoav was, we'll see, but says Tosfot, Yoav himself was very loyal. So why would calling Yoav his commander be an act of insubordination? And therefore, Omer Rabbi Meir Aviv Shua ben Utam. Therefore, he offers a different opinion in the name of Rabbi Meir, the father of Rabbi Utam. And before I even get to what he says, this comment is extraordinary. But we need to understand a little bit of history to realize how unique this moment in Tosfot is. Who is Rabbi Meir Aviv Shua ben Utam? So if you remember, I don't know if you know the lineage of Rashi, but Rashi had famously had a number of daughters. One, he also had a number of very famous grandchildren. I think I've mentioned before that one of Rashi's grandchildren was the Rashbam, who debates with Rashi over many comments in the Chumash, but both were commentary on the Chumash. Rashbam is, I think, of Shmuel ben Meir. There are three children of Rabbi Meir who are known as part of the Balei HaTosfot, part of the time frame of the Tosfot. One is Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, known as the Rashbam. The other is Rabbi Yaakov. I think it's Yosef or Rabbi Yaakov. I don't know, the Yud. Rivam, Reish Yud Bet Mem, stands for one of them. Maybe it's Rabbi Yitzchok. And then there's this Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam is Rabbi Yaakov ben Rabbi Meir. Rabbeinu Tam is also one of Rashi's grandchildren. So Rashi has three famous grandchildren who are mentioned in Tosfot: Rashbam, Rivam, and Rabbeinu Tam. They're all the sons of Rabbi Meir, which means Rabbi Meir is Rashi's son-in-law. So we have to understand the context here. This is a conversation about the nature of Uriah and the relationship with David and the unraveling the mystery of David and Bathsheba. And it's a debate taking place between Rashi and his son-in-law. So can you imagine what the Shabbos table was like? Right? You have a family gathering, and Rashi and Rabbeinu Meir are having a debate about Uriah. Was he rebellious? Who wasn't he rebellious? Why was he rebellious? Right? The Shabbos table is ablaze with this discussion between Rashi and Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is Rashi's son-in-law. But unless you realize that this comment kind of just gets glossed over, okay, Rabbi Meir of Yishua ben Atam, but wait a second, that's Rashi's son-in-law. So that's this debate between Rashi and his son-in-law. Okay, close parentheses. What did Rabbi Meir say? Masha amalo David she'elech levito lechov lishtot. When David said to him that he should go home to his wife, eat, drink, go home to his wife, v'humi en badavar, and Uriah refused. That refusal of Uriah to go home to his wife, k'dichtiv kol abdei adonai, adonai apnei asadechonim, b'ani avo abeti lecho, everybody is sitting on the field and I should go home to my wife, b'timir with a question mark. V'lo ayala l'saret, he should never have refused. David gave him a direct order. Refusing to go home to his wife, says Tosfot, is the equivalent of refusing a direct command from your commanding officer. Refusing a direct command from your commanding officer is an act of treason. And treason in warfare is punishable by death. So Tosfot says that's exactly what is going on. So I want to start with Tosfot, even though I think from a pshat perspective, I think Rashi is probably closer to the mark. But I want to start with Tosfot. What Tosfot is saying is that when Uriah expresses this deep desire to go back to the war front, to be with his war buddies, to be on the field, everybody is up nesedechonim, and I should go home and I should have should eat and drink and stuff my face with food and lishkav mishti, that that's instead of being with my buddies on the battlefield, that that's insubordination punishable by death. It's a hard position to argue or defend. Especially because if you look at David's, in the language of David's request, David doesn't pose this as a command. He says to him, okay, go home to your house, wash your feet, and tomorrow you'll go back to the war. Even when he challenges him the second time, you've come from afar away. Why don't you go home to your house? It doesn't sound to me like David is giving him a direct order. I'm ordering you to go home to you. Doesn't say that. So if it's not a direct order and Uriah refuses, then to hold him accountable for refusing a direct order, which wasn't formulated or in the language of an order, that's odd. Right? That's just odd. So on the other hand, if, and this is a big if Uriah is suspicious of David's behavior, whether he knows it or he doesn't know it, or he knows it or suspects it. But if he is suspicious that there's something going on between David and Bathsheba, then his refusal to go home is more than just a refusal to abide by a command of the king that was formulated as a simple request, but it's really a command that's a refusal to participate in David's cover-up. Which from David's perspective is treasonous. Again, objectively, the Navi will hold him accountable, but from David's perspective, that refusal, if it's motivated by a suspicion of the king, could be more problematic. I'll even go one step further. I want to take a really hard look at Pasuk Yud Aleph. Again, this is all assuming Tosfot's position. We're going to flip this around in a minute. But assuming Tosfot's position, Vayomer Uriah al David, Uriah's response here, which is the centerpiece of this discussion, is as follows. I am a loyal soldier. I belong on the battlefield. Aaron v'Yisrael v'Yudah yoshvim basukot. The Ark, Israel, Judah are in booths, meaning in the uniform, encamped in tents. V'Adoni Yoav, my master Yoav, a phrase we'll come back to. All of the army is encamped on the open field. I should go home to my house to eat and drink and to sleep with my wife. On your life, I will not do this thing. What thing will he not do? On your life, my king, chayecha, which is also an odd way to address the king. Normally you address the king in third person. Chaye melech. Chayecha v'chayin nafshecha, your life, your soul. To address the king in second person is very odd. We'll look at that in a moment. But he's very clear. He takes an oath on by the king's life that he will not do this thing. What will he not do? He will not, while everybody else is on the battlefield, he will not go home to eat. What's wrong with eating? To drink? What's wrong with drinking? Water, juice, maybe. V'lishkavim ishti. Or to sleep with my wife. Chayecha v'chay nafshecha imeaseh et hadavar hazeh. On your life, I will not do this thing. Does anybody else hear in these words a ringing critique of David? Well, all the soldiers are on the battlefield. That is not a time for me to spend frolicking at home with my wife. Maybe that's best off left for you, the king. To go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife. You hear the critique? The reference here that ani avo el beiti, that I should go home to my house, lishkav im ishti, to lie with my wife, im eeset adavar zef, I will do this thing. There is within these words a kind of subtle critique of David, maybe not so subtle. I am not going to the middle of the battle, going to go frolic in Yerushalayim and go home to my wife. That's for other people to do. Maybe for the king to do. Here in Yerushalayim, walking on these rooftops. Right. I should go home to my house. El Beti, you can go to my house. If Uriah is aware of a suspicion of what has taken place, then I hear that suspicion in the latter half of this sentence. I will not go home to my wife. You, David? Different story. And if that's right, when Tosfot says that Uriah's refusal to go home, it was an act of insubordination and treason in the eyes of David. There's no greater insubordination and treason in the eyes of David than to imply that David has been inappropriate with his wife. Right? That implication, which he's now made, by the way, in public, because this conversation is not happening in private, this conversation is happening in public. That accusation in public is treasonous. David can't let that go, especially if he wants to cover up what's going on. But even without that, the public critique of the king is really quite extraordinary. Even though David is absolutely 1,000% dead wrong. His night with Bathsheba was wrong. His cover up with Uriah is wrong. His attempt ultimately to have Uriah sentenced to death is wrong. But from David's vantage point, David's justification of his night with Bathsheba is legal. And Uriah's refusal to go down to his home is insubordinate and is chutzpah and is public. And there's a Gemara that says that Yoram ben Nevat, the first king to Yoram ben Nevat, the first king to split apart the kingdom in the days of Shlomo Melech, that Yoram ben Nevat was rewarded because he criticized Shlomo for all of Shlomo's vices, but he was punished because he did so publicly. It's Gemara in Sanhedrin. It's on the source page. מפנימה זכה ירבעם למחות מפני שוכיח את שלמה. ומפנימה נענש מפני שוכיחו ברבים. He was rewarded for criticizing Shlomo for all of his vices, but he was punished for doing so in public. It's a time and place. David, with all of his vices, with all of his misdeeds here, and with all of his problems, he's still the king. And for Uriah to publicly dress him down in this way, implying that he behaved inappropriately, is says Tosfot that is an act of rebellion. Okay.
Well, it's interesting that David doesn't try to kill him until he refuses him here. He doesn't immediately go to try to kill him.
Why would he? He has no justification, and B, he has no reason. If Uriah would have gone back to his house and spent the night with his wife, that would have been the end of the story. From David's perspective, he would have been... David does not devise Uriah's death until after this conversation. And that's why the Gemara says, in David's mind, the orchestration of Uriah's death is not driven by a desire to cover up the child. It's driven by Uriah's insubordination here. Uriah's chutzpah here, Uriah's treason here. And this is the centerpiece of the conversation.
He could have just tried to kill him. He could have just originally had him killed to just take his wife. Like, he could have done it that way, but he didn't.
That's just murder. David's not going to commit. Remember, David is caught in a trap of self-justification, but he's not an evil. Right? David is not a murderer.
I'm just pointing that out.
Not going to take an innocent person and commit murder. Right? When Uriah, in David's mind, commits insubordination and treason, then David says, "Okay, now you've committed a crime punishable by death. That is true." But he's not going to take Uriah and just have Uriah killed. I might ask Uriah to go home and cover up his tracks, but he's not going to orchestrate the death of somebody who's innocent.
Not in David's mind. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
How do we know that it was public again? Where is it saying that?
I don't see anywhere where it's not public. I mean, David is challenging, he calls for Uriah. David is told, he calls him. These conversations are not private. These conversations are usually very public. Happening with the entourage of the Avdei HaMelech, he sends him out with a he goes out with a mess of food from the king. This is all happening in the palace. This is all happening on the throne. All right. So that's all built around one assumption, which is that Uriah's response to David is insubordinate and treasonous because he refuses to go to his wife. He refuses David's direct command. And the assumption is that he does so because he knows, or at least is suspicious of David. Rashi, on the other hand, took a very different position. And Rashi says that the mered, the rebellion here, the insubordination, has nothing to do with Bathsheba. And in fact, I would argue in Rashi's defense that Uriah knows nothing about Bathsheba. I suspect that that's also closer to the pshat of the story. I don't hear in the story anywhere where Uriah is aware of what happened with Bathsheba. But what Uriah does is he lands on a minefield. He literally stomps on a mine that explodes in his face. And that mine is the words Adoni Yoav. And he calls Yoav his Lord and Master. And that's where I want to start the discussion. So let's go back to this conversation. This conversation is at the centerpiece of it, Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph. Let's come back to this conversation. David starts this conversation with what seems to be a very polite question. Let's start from there. David says to Uriah, "Hello, miderech ataba, you've come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah's response is angry. The tone of Uriah's response is an oath, is ridiculing David's request. And on top of it, he throws in a whole discussion of the army, the ark and Israel and Judah and the soldiers. They're all in tents. They're all in the camp. They're all on the battlefield. And I should go home to my wife. Uriah's response is angry. David's request sounded very innocent. So one of two possibilities. It's possible that David just asked the sensitive question and Uriah exploded. It's also possible that what we're shown here in the text is the beginning and the end of a conversation, but that the conversation itself may have had more details to it. In other words, when David asks Uriah, "Madua lo yoradata betecha," that's not just a question. It's a question that is driven by a lot of information which David has in his head, and now maybe is the time that conversation gets put on the table. We already established the fact that Bathsheba is without a child. Uriah and Bathsheba have been married for however long they've been married. Uriah has been out on the battlefield for so many months and years. Uriah has been a loyal servant in David's circle and group from the days that he was running as a refugee with 400 men. Uriah is a professional soldier. And Nebuch, poor Bathsheba, is at home, war widow, without her husband. When David says to him, "Madua lo yoradat al betecha," I hear in the question, why don't you go home to your wife, your poor wife? She's alone. She's there. She's neglected. You're out on the battlefield all day, all months and years at a time. Oh yeah, there's a time and place for everything. What happened to Shana Rishana? What happened to your first year at home? What happened to the Samachat Ishto? You should be to please your wife. You have a responsibility. Uriah, why are you neglecting your home and your domestic duties? Madua lo yaradata el betecha, Uriah. Why are you neglecting your domestic responsibilities? Okay. Uriah's answer to each of these parts of the conversation. The Ark in Israel and Judah are sitting in Sukkot. My master Yoav, my master, and my servants of my master are encamped in the field. I'm a professional soldier. I am in the midst of a great battle. We've come from a war with Aram. We've come from a war with Ammon and Moab. This is a war for the defense of Israel. This is a border city. This is defending the integrity of the nation of Israel. This is a melchemet mitzvah. You know, the whole issue about a man not going off to war in his first year of marriage only applies to an optional war. It doesn't apply to a melchemet mitzvah. An obligatory war is a war of self-defense. Everybody has to go and fight in a war of self-defense. My dear king, my dear David, this is a war of essential war, Muhammad Mitzvah, a war that is critical to the security of Israel. We have been sitting on the battlefield for now a better part of a year in this siege war of Rabat Ben Ammon. The soldiers are weary, soldiers are tired, they need leadership. And Adoni Yoav and my master, my commander Yoav, is sitting there with us on the battlefield because that's where the master belongs. That's where the commander belongs. David says, I'm not there. Okay, you're right, you're not there. All your other soldiers are there. All your soldiers are sitting on the battlefield. What are you doing, David? Walking on the top of your rooftop, taking a spazier? Mitayel gag beito? The point I'm trying to drive home, maybe a little dramatically, is that this innocent conversation is filled filled with innuendo. It's filled with implied critique from both sides. From David, who is trying to defend the integrity of the dignity of a woman whose husband has gone off to war and has neglected her for since the day they were married, and somehow David becomes the defender of her emotional state of being. You're needed at home, and Uriah looks at his commander and says, "My dear king, my commander is on the battlefield. Where are you?" Now. Did Uriah intend to accuse David of neglecting his soldiers? I don't think so. Nor do I think that David intended to accuse Uriah of neglecting his wife. But I think that the nature of the conversation was so filled with tension over these two issues that have been at the centerpiece of this discussion that before you know it, they are exploding at each other. And Uriah's response is angry. Now, I don't care if Uriah is 100% justified in his critique of David. You're talking to the king of Israel. And to the king of Israel, you cannot say that you have neglected your troops. Moreover, to the king of Israel, you cannot call a servant your master. That's not done. Talking to the king, you refer to from the second in command on down as the servants of the king. You never address the king in second person. On your life, chayecha, it's always in third person, the king. The servants, Adon, to refer to Yoav as his master is nothing short of treasonous. Yoav is his commander in chief, is his commander on the battlefield. Yoav is not his commander in chief. His commander in chief is David. And when you talk to David, you refer to Yoav as Avdecha Yoav, your servant Yoav. I'll show you an example in Shmuel Bet Perek Yedaleh. This is a story a little bit later, a couple of chapters later. I'm not going to get into the details of the story, not our issue, but she's talking to David, this particular individual, and she's telling him a story, and David asks her if Yoav had a hand in the story. And she responds, Vayomer HaMelech, the king says, Hayad Yoav itach b'chozot, has Yoav been involved in the story? Is he the one who put you up to this? Atana Isha v'tomer, if you're going to speak in second person, at least say Adoni HaMelech, right? But on the life of the king, im ish lehiminu lehasmol mikol shediber Adoni HaMelech ki avdecha Yoav hu tzivan. Your servant Yoav is the one who in fact instructed. That's how you refer to Yoav, avdecha Yoav. You're talking to the king to call Yoav my Adon, Adoni Yoav, that is treasonous. Now, I have no doubt that it was a slip of the tongue. But to David, it was treason, it was insubordination, it was rebellion, it was everything that he suspected in Uriah at that moment. It all comes crumbling, crashing down. To call the general on the battlefield, his commander, Adoni Yoav, when you're talking to the king, and then there's the second phrase, Avde Adoni, the servants of my master, which most of the Mefarshim read as the servants of my master referring to the king, but in the context here, what sounds much more plausible is that he's calling Yoav his Adon, and the soldiers, the soldiers of their master, meaning Yoav, because Yoav is not as loyal to them. Yoav is on the battlefield with them. And David is sitting spatzering on his rooftop. And Yoav and Uriah is angry and he's frustrated. All of that's mine that Uriah steps on. There's one more part of his mind. And there's no way in the world that Uriah could have possibly anticipated how devastating a mine he stepped on. If there's anybody in David's service who you do not want to call out as a challenge to the throne, it's Yoav. Why? If there's anybody who the last thing you want to do in David's presence is to say to David that Yoav is that the person talking to David is more loyal to Yoav than he is to David. It's the last thing in the world you want to do. And probably the last thing in the world you will do.
Probably because Yoav has power as the Yoav general.
Has power. And because Yoav has been a threat to David from the beginning. And we've seen this. Who killed Avner ben Ner, Tsar Tzava of Shaul, against David's direct instructions? Yoav. And when Yoav kills Avner, puts David in a terrible position vis-a-vis the newly formed, unique partnership with the kingdoms of Judah and Israel, and David has to defend the fact that he didn't kill Ishbosheth. Oh, I didn't kill Avner. Avner came to him in peace. Yoav stabs David in the back. He kills Avner. Yoav is even David's response to him is to describe Avner. Sorry, to describe Yoav as What's the expression he uses? It's not on this list. But he describes, he says, it's in Paragimel. He says, "Ha'anashima ela b'nei tsuya kashim mimeni." These b'nei tsuya, these sons of tsuya, Avner and his two brothers, Amasa and Avishai, are difficult people. That was in Paragimel. Later on, after Sheva ben Bichri, the story of Sheva ben Bichri tries to curse David, or rebel against David, Avishai wants to try to kill him, and David's response is, "Ma liva lachem b'nei tsuya? What am I going to do with you guys, b'nei tsuya?" Next week, I'll show you. I'm going to run out of time now, so I'll show you this next week. But next week, we'll open with this. When it comes to the battle, you know, I'll just show you quickly. When it comes to the battle of Avshalom, the rebellion of Avshalom, David's final instructions to his army, to his soldiers, his direct instruction to Yoav was not to harm Avshalom, bring Avshalom home alive. In the battlefield, a certain man saw and told Yoav that Avshalom was hanging from a tree, that Avshalom was alive and he had been trapped. Why didn't you kill him? So the man says to Yoav, he says, I will not put my hand against the king's son. Your brother, we all heard the king's charge. You, Avishai, your brother, Itai, Giti, we all heard the king say, don't touch Avshalom. ויאמר יואב לא כן אוכילה לפניך ויקח שלושה שבטים בכפו ויתקיים בלב אבשלום. יואב says, I don't care. I will take them, and he takes his spears and he thrusts them through and he kills Avshalom. Then he threatens David, and then David tries to depose him, and he forces his way back into the position of commander. Yoav is an extraordinarily difficult and strong and threatening personality that David puts up with, but David is constantly aware that Yoav is a threat to him. On his deathbed, he turns to Shlomo HaMelech, to his son Shlomo, and he says, "You deal with Yoav, because I never could." And just to make life more interesting, Yoav is Ben Tsruya, and Tsruya is David's sister. So, just to make life more interesting, Yoav is David's nephew, which is a piece of information we discovered last year. And into all of this, it's like throwing a match into a field of dry twigs. And it's a cinder box. Uriah steps on the mine and he calls Yoav his commander, his lord. My lord Yoav is on the battlefield, loyal to his soldiers, implying you, David, are not. And in David's mind, nothing else matters. At this moment in time, Uriah has committed high treason. And what will happen next is David will orchestrate the death of Uriah for having committed treason. Nothing to do with Bathsheba. David doesn't have Uriah killed because of Bathsheba. David has Uriah killed because he committed treason in his conversation with David by daring to call Yoav his commander. That is Rashi's interpretation of the story. I think from a Pshat perspective, he's hit a very powerful piece and a very powerful nerve in the story.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, and it could be because I wasn't in the previous classes. So if Yoav is this bone of contention, apparently very treasonous, because he disobeyed direct orders, why did David not deal with him? And second, if this is treasonous and punishable by death, why is the Navi so upset?
Oh, So that's the Gemara's question. That's exactly the first question. I don't really have an answer to, except because David says it himself. David says back in Perek Gimel that he's young and he's weak, and Yoav is more powerful than he is, and there's nothing he can do about it, and so he has to live with him. All right, that's David says that. I there's nothing I can do about it. It is, I'll show you the pasuk. Shmuel bet Perek Gimel, after he kills Avner, Ve'etzeyu Av me'im David, Ve'ishlach malachim achrei Avner, Yoav sends messengers, he calls Avner back, he kills him ostensibly in a moment of peace, and ledaber to Basheli, and he kills him, he stabs him, and David is forced into a terrible public apology, and then he says, in Pasuk Lamitet, Ve'yomer ha'melech al avadav, know that there is a prince and a great man who fell today in Israel, namely Avner Bener. And I am today just anointed, Mashuach Melech, and weak, young. These sons of Tzruya, Yoav and Avishai, kashimi meni, they're too difficult for me. Let God pay back the evildoer according to his wickedness. So says David about Yoav ben Tzruya. Back in Perek Gimel. You have to know what you're dealing with. Yoav is a tough bully. He's a tough character. And sometimes, you know what, even the greatest people, you know, dealing with these people, even from a position of strength of David puts up with them. Your second question is exactly what the Gemara asks. Well, if he's really guilty of insubordination and treason, then why does the Navi hold David accountable? So the Gemara's answer is she'yalecha laduno b'Sanhedrin. Because you should not have judged him. You should have let the Sanhedrin do that. Now, let's understand what that means. There's a whole discussion in the halacha, which is not really relevant because this isn't really about halacha, but there's a whole discussion in the halacha. A real Morid B'Malchus, a real person who commits treason against the king in the midst of the war, it's a military tribunal. Person who deserts the battlefront in the midst of war, till today, right? If you have a soldier in the midst of a battlefield who turns to and wants to run in the middle of a war, his commander can take him, call it a drum trial, right? Turn a drum upside down and have a trial on the battlefield and put him to death for committing treason. It's a crime punishable by death. That's, by the way, still true today. Because the act of treason in the time of war is seditious and potentially life-threatening to the entire army. So a Sanhedrin, somebody who's really marred by Malchus, the king would normally deal with it. But there's one individual who's marred by Malchus who the king cannot deal with, who should not deal with, who should not be in a position to be judging Uriah. And that's David. The last person in the world to be holding Uriah accountable for anything is David. Can you honestly say that David is objective in his assessment of Uriah? I don't care if Uriah landed on 100 mines. Is David objective? Is Uriah going to get a fair hearing in David's court? When given the benefit of the benefit of doubt? The notion to judge your fellow righteously, according to all the mafarshim, means to give somebody the benefit of the doubt. Can David give Uriah any kind of benefit of the doubt? When the Gemara says that they should have judged him in a Sanhedrin, what the Gemara I think means is, had the Sanhedrin gotten involved, had David said to the Sanhedrin, what are your thoughts about Uriah's statement? I'm sure they would have found sufficient evidence to say that Uriah's comment was a slip of the tongue and was not intended to be treasonous. I have no doubt. But David took that on himself, wrote the famous letter, and had Uriah put to death. for, in David's mind, for treason, not for anything to do with Bathsheba. But that's where the tragedy goes from one, that's the spiral, that's that's the rabbit hole. Once David goes down it, he can't explicate himself from it. And yeah, there's a question. Somebody had a question. Robbie, you had a hand raised? Your virtual hand got raised. All right. But so we have overstayed our time, and we're going to adjourn here. We have much work still ahead of us, but at least we've begun to understand the complexity, I hope, between the relationship between David and Uriah that has been part of this discussion. As about Hashem, next week we will pick up from here.
Amen. Yeshua koach, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Have a good Hanukkah. You too. All the best to you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Be well.